part of the Press Play Podcast Network.
Hey, before we get to today's episode, I want to spend a few moments to thank you for checking out this podcast. It truly means a lot. I started Press Play Podcast in 2018, and 5 years in, we've grown to about 16 shows with over 20 hosts and have a handful of contracted producers. It's a great little operation with two shows in the top 5% of all podcasts and some of the best hosts and journalists you'll ever find. I've learned so much and absolutely love talking to people that have helped me become who I am today. If you're interested in learning more about Press Play Podcast, you can check out our website at pressplaypodcast.com or search us in any podcast platform you use. We mainly cover sports and entertainment. We have a Browns podcast, a Cleveland Cavs podcast, a Guardians podcast, a baseball card collecting podcast, and two other sports talk shows. We also have a movie podcast, the Fanfare podcast, which I co-host, a book club podcast, a TV show podcast, a Marvel podcast, a DC podcast, and even a Broadway show podcast. My show is very nuanced. I hope you enjoy it. If you do, feel free to subscribe and leave a 5-star review. That will help other people know that you enjoyed the show. So without further ado, Tommy Bechtold and I in defense of the Phantom Menace. Thanks. Welcome to the Chase Smith Podcast, a conversation on current events and culture. We are proudly part of the Press Play Podcast Network, empowering diverse voices to launch professional engaging podcasts. I've been MIA for a while, been hosting Cavs on the Break throughout the NBA season. Then you mix in Advent and Lent into the mix, and all of a sudden, the second podcast, it's your name, kind of drops on the things that you need to do list. But alas, when duty calls, you have to answer no matter the circumstance. And a couple weeks ago, let me explain the situation here. A couple weeks ago, on Twitter, new rock stars, the premiere breakdown, recap, theorizing content of your favorite movies and shows. I'm talking Marvel, DC, Star Wars, Game of Thrones, pretty much anything, nerd fandom. They're the go-to on YouTube to break it down and talk about it. They made a post in the effect of, what's the most controversial Star Wars take that you will defend to the end? It has like 8.9 million views. I tweeted, Phantom Menace is the best prequel movie. And because I'm a sucker and I pay $8 a month for a little blue check, it's one of the first things that people read and was immediately ratioed by a new rock star's reply, proving my point. I think they got like three times more likes. New rock stars tweeted a gif of Anakin yelling liar from Revenge of the Sith. And so I was like, all right, I have to defend it now. I have to actually follow through with my post. And here to help me, person no stranger to the new Rockstars world or the Star Wars world, he has been featured as a Star Wars expert on New Rockstars itself. He also hosts a podcast called Guardians of the Galaxy. He's an actor, writer. Tommy Bechtold. Tommy, thanks for coming on the Chase Smith podcast, man.
Chase, welcome to the club of distinguished tweeters that have been ratioed replying to a new Rockstars tweet. It's a badge of honor, baby. Wear it like a war medal. So
I do. Another thing that I wear like a war medal, Tommy, is I've been yelled and chastised by Billy Eichner before. And it was just so special. They were doing like a Spotify live.
Yeah.
When Spotify was toying with like live.
Yeah, I remember that. Rooms. Yeah.
And he was just releasing his movie that he wrote. I forget the name of the movie too.
Boys.
Boys. Yeah. He was promoting Boys. He was doing a live Q&A and I was in my car and I was like, yeah, I have a question for him. And so I requested to speak and they threw to me, but then I got all nervous and tried to go to my AirPods and it was going back and forth. And he was like, Jesus Christ, where are you? A tunnel? And I was just like, oh my gosh, that this means so much. So anyway.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Tommy, our orbits, we talked before the show and we'll get to the Phantom Menace in a few moments.
Yes, please.
But our orbits have circled for a while.
Yes.
You almost joined the network before COVID.
I did. I think COVID killed my my podcast career. But, you know, much like Star Wars, people come back as Force ghosts. Maybe I'll be a Force ghost podcaster. So never rule it out.
The idea, do you want to hold the idea near and dear? Do you want to share?
No, I love the idea. And honestly, I still have dreams of executing it. And if not, someone else just steal it from me. But the idea was called Crying in the Theater.
Yes,
it was. And it was about opening up about movies that make you cry in
it's
the
a safe
theater.
space.
And
It's a safe
yeah,
space.
and how, you know, and honestly, we were ahead of the time because Nicole
Yeah.
Kidman has made a lot of money off of this concept and those AMC ads.
Yes.
Somehow heartbreak feels good in a place like this. And that was my point.
That was
Like,
it.
when I was a, like, I mean, I can remember vividly, and this is a soft pitch for anyone listening, the first time I can remember crying in a movie theater was A League of Their Own, which is a great Penny Marshall movie about women playing professional baseball when all the men went off to World War II. And there's just so many relatable themes in it, even as a, I think I must have been like 8 or 9, even as an 8 or 9 year old, the family, the elements of strong family bonds and how family, you know, eventually all you have is your family after everything else fades away. I just remember being like an 8 year old bawling my eyes out in that theater and being like, oh God, I'm crying in the theater. And then I looked over and my dad was crying harder than me. And I was like, oh, okay, all right. Dad's crying. So anyway, I digress. Crying in the theater. Maybe coming to a year soon. Who
no,
knows?
And I love our concept art. So we developed
it's
a
so
logo.
Good. It's so good. It's better than I deserve.
It's like the intermission popcorn and Slurpee, and they're like bawling and crying on a theater screen. It was great. We
so
loved
good.
The idea.
Yeah.
So anyway, loved it. So anyway, I was like, I gotta ask Tommy.
Yes.
My wife and I were watching, I think, The Book of Boba Fett, I think, or Mando season 3, and we would default to new rock stars because
yes, the smash hit show WikiLeaks with Eric Voss and I believe we're talking about our Star Wars after show now featuring Maude Garrett, Eric Voss, and hopefully myself. I don't know. I have acolytes coming up. I haven't been told I've been replaced. So
and I was like, that guy looks familiar. I was like,
didn't we make a bunch of concept art for him only to have him flake on us?
No. I was like, he looks really familiar. And I was racking my brain, and it was one of those, like, I don't know why. And like, I felt like it was like the middle of the night, cold sweat, like, oh, you're the theater.
Yeah.
Really honored to be talking Star Wars
with
you, Tommy.
All mine.
Let's talk about Phantom Menace.
Yes.
I love Phantom Menace. I
yes.
do think it's the best of the prequels. And I want to start here in defense of the Phantom Menace. I want to call it the last Jedi conundrum. All right. So let's go back. Well, George Lucas was writing a prequel to the world changing trilogy of Star Wars.
Yes.
And so he had like this end game in mind, right? He knew he had to get to Darth Vader. He knew that was about the Skywalker family, but more importantly, I think, was this problem of, oh man, all the Jedi are extinct and they're like folklore, and how am I going to do that? What am I going to do? Very similarly to Rian Johnson when The Last Jedi, Luke was exiled. Like, what?
Right.
What am I going to do? How am I going to make this make sense? And how he layered, and like, now it's like, oh, like he's playing 4D chess. Like truly once you see all the, like, I'm giving him a lot of credit here, Tommy, but I really think, what else was he to do in this situation?
Well, I agree with you. And I think, you know, obviously with all of the Filoni extensions with the animated series and the live action series that have fleshed out kind of some of the, not to use a real buzzword, but the lore of the Phantom Menace that was kind of seeds planted in the Phantom Menace that were basically time-traveling seeds from 1977, like tiny seeds in A New Hope that then became, you know, plants in Phantom Menace that were like, you know, these are like, Dave Filoni talks about, you know, really getting immersed in the notes of George Lucas, once George Lucas kind of really trusted him to like, kind of shepherd Star Wars through Clone Wars and Rebels. And it's like, George Lucas has all these like non-linear ideas about what the Star Wars universe is, not necessarily just the timeline of the Skywalkers. And he has to start somewhere. And he starts with the Phantom Menace. And we have, you know, at the time we're going to get into it, it's like, people were just kind of like, it just wasn't enough like A New Hope for them. And then ironically, that became the biggest criticism of The Force Awakens, was it was too much like A New Hope.
Yeah.
It's like they course corrected exactly what people's complaint was for A Phantom Menace. And then people were like, no, not this time.
Yeah.
Now we like a fan. Because I do think, to be fair to viewing audiences, a lot of people have come around on A Phantom Menace in a way that like, they haven't so much on Attack of the Clones. They've definitely forgiven the Phantom Menace a much, or at least sought to understand and given a little more good faith to a Phantom Menace.
Yes. Well, the dialogue is so bad. The love scenes, yeah. Like is so bad.
Yeah.
Side tangent. You know who loved Attack of the Clones? My 6-year-old daughter, when she first watched it, she
really
loved it.
I've heard kids now are like responding to all the whole trilogy, all the prequels as a whole. It's like, those are their favorites.
But you know what? Watching it through her eyes made me remember, like, who is Star Wars for?
Yeah, right.
This is going to be the very end of the podcast, but here we are. Like, who are these movies for?
You're right. It's for, you know, imaginative minds, mostly children, and then by extension, their family with them. Like, the best part of Star Wars is experiencing it with your family. I went to Force Awakens with my brother one time, my dad one time, with my mom one time. Three different separate viewings because they knew how much it mattered to me. So they were by proxy excited to go see it with me. I don't even know if any of them had any idea. They probably haven't thought about Star Wars since, like, you know, the prequels came out, you know, 15 years before, when the last prequel came out in 2003 or 2002 or whatever. I don't know. But anyway, for Phantom Menace, I do think really the achievement of George Lucas going back and trying to tell the events that led to this crazy trilogy, this, like you said, world changing trilogy. It's like, I don't even know the comparison of, like, I guess, you know, kind of like, it's basically been executed once, The Hobbit, as a prequel to The Lord of the Rings saga.
Culture changing and film entertainment changing. Yes. It's not just like culturally, it's like, oh, they changed the industry.
Right.
And which he went back and tinkered with. So, like, he's like, this isn't something he's well aware of what he's done.
Yeah. He's poured plenty of gasoline on the fan fire for sure. Special editioning these movies to death, but
But the Last Jedi conundrum of how in one generation am I going to make the Jedi, those guys are just old wizards.
Yeah.
Who were like the peacekeeper guardians.
Yeah, they were the superheroes. They were the Avengers or the Justice League of this galaxy. It was like, you're right. And by the time we meet old crazy old Ben Kenobi, they're completely, they're erased so far from, like you said, in one generation, they're erased so far that people don't even necessarily believe they're real.
Yes.
Which is crazy.
Insane. And so for him to be like, okay, I know I have Vader. I know that we have to get them extinct. And so I just think it was genius. And again, this is giving Lucas a lot of credit here. But to introduce this Federation and to build it through the world building he continued to do outside of what he did with the original trilogy is just, I think, deserves a lot of credit. How he was able to retcon or whatever word you want to use there to fit some of these restraints that he kind of unknowingly built himself.
I agree. I think it's true. And I think also with that, he created an entire kind of cultural discourse of like talking about it and like talking about how fiction, you know, how retconning really works for a saga, for a giant kind of monolithic franchise like Star Wars. Mm-hmm. It's like, How do we deal with retconning? How do we deal with like things that don't necessarily line up as a perfect, you know, A to B connection? I'm doing hand motions on an audio only podcast, so that you know I'm doing great when that's happening. But I think he does deserve credit. I think he's really smart, and I think one of the laziest dunks on Star Wars is that like it's stupid or it's cheesy. You know what I mean? Like it can be cheesy. It's like, I don't think George Lucas is a master of like socializing and social skills. I think he's a really good sci-fi fantasy storyteller. And like, if you're looking for like, you know, characters that are written like Fonzie, you're probably not going to find that, right? Like you're not going to find that. Again, a nice 50-year-old reference for me. How's everyone doing today? who's cool now on TV? I don't even know.
He wrote cool in Han Solo, which might be the Fonzie of the outer space.
But- yeah.
clearly if you watch like any love scenes, like dude is way just like relatable.
He's like, I'm actually more comfortable if they can't kiss because they're brother and sister. Like, right. Like, why don't I just make it impossible for everyone? And his cool, the way he wrote Han Solo cool was just to make him angry at everyone.
Yeah, like, and like, not buying into what he's doing. Exactly. Like the and yeah. So yeah. My exhibit A in defense of the Phantom Menace is what else could he have done to get to A New Hope? And I don't think there was a lot of options for him to do. Exhibit B, I have one here, Tommy. And if you want to add any, feel free. Exhibit B, the theme of just how everything is connected in the Phantom Menace, kind of, you know, piggybacking off of Exhibit A, but just this theme in this movie, how everything is connected, the Trade Federation and the galaxy and the Jedi and the Sith and the Galactic Republic and even the Gungans and the Naboo, how they don't realize they're there, but they're all connected, how the Jedi and they're freeing slaves and just how Anakin and just how everything is connected, still juggling all of that, but being able to have this common thread of, oh, here's Obi-Wan and oh, here's, you know, Qui-Gon and hey, here's Yoda. And all, so just how everything here is connected I just think at a deeper level, very, very well done. But that's not my favorite exhibit, Tommy. It's not my favorite in defense of Phantom Menace.
Oh, well, what is?
The new things that we see in Phantom Menace. The new things, man. Yes. I'm talking like things you only read or have seen in video games. Jedi light speed, like Jedi speed, Jedi jumps, the Sith lore. The dual, like the not a quite Mexican standoff, which is my Star Wars dream, having a Mexican, a three-way one-on-one battle. We haven't seen that yet, but like a one-on-two battle, new planets, new special creatures, new Jedi, new lightsabers, new enemies, like all of this new, it was just so much new stuff and it was awesome.
I think that is, I think that's a bullseye. I don't have it necessarily an addenda or another exhibit. I completely agree. And to piggyback on that, I think the explanation of how the Empire didn't just pop up out of nowhere as like the Emperor is this mysterious, you know, like warlock that has somehow put the entire, you know, the entire Empire under his knee or bent them to his will. It's like, no, a vacuum of power happened and he was able to sow through basically the Sith, which are the anti-Jedi. He was able to sow enough paranoia in regular, well-intentioned people, including Senator Jar Jar Binks. And these are later movies, but it's like, but these are established in this first film in a new,
everything's connected.
Yes. And I will say maybe as an appendix, look how well the performances of Liam Neeson and Ewan McGregor have aged. How much we were clamoring for Qui-Gon in Obi-Wan, and how much like you could, we can debate another time on the Obi-Wan show, which I think was destroyed by its own reshoots and tinkering. I think the original idea for that show, even as a movie, probably was way more entertaining. I also think that show exists for those two Vader Kenobi fight scenes. Oh, and if those alone are enough to make me fanboy out enough on it. But I mean, think about those two performances and how when you go back and watch, and even Jake Lloyd, and an interesting thing I read in an article on one of the fan sites, probably comicbook.com or something like that, about Jake Lloyd's mom talking about how he, like, contrary to what people think, like, he really loved making that movie. Like, the fan reception, I'm sure, you know, this is pre-Twitter, you know, so he probably didn't, a lot of the fan reception he got was probably to his face, which is like, you think about how hard that
letters to his house.
Yeah, like, letters to his house and shit like weirdos. That. But it's like, she said it was more afterwards is what kind of what spiraled him into have all the personal problems that he's had. But I guess he's doing a lot better now and is even like kind of like embracing the same way Hayden Christensen kind of got a mulligan and got a like the fans kind of, I think, I mean, at a certain point, you get a dearth of new fans coming in and watching these prequel movies. And they're like, I actually like the guy who plays Anakin Skywalker, meaning as an adult Hayden Christensen. It's like, all of a sudden, we're a lot kinder to his performance. And I think with Jake Lloyd, a similar thing is going to happen. He's a kid actor. And think about, he plays a kid actor who literally is like a Pixar character. And that's going to become the most feared person in the galaxy. That little, like, munchkin is going to become Darth Vader. That has to exist. And it's like, I think, like, it's again kind of bad faith to be like, I didn't like the way this 7-year-old played Darth Vader. Well, he's not Darth Vader. He's Anakin Skywalker. He's a little kid who likes to tinker with machines, foreshadowing Luke's same love for, you know, tinkering with machines and droids. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. But.
Yeah, no, and hopefully he gets his redeeming moment like Hayden has, the guy who plays Jar Jar Binks. I forget.
Yeah, I'm at best.
Yes, yeah, he was in Mando 3.
Yep.
As the Jedi who saved
He rescued Grogu, yes.
Which is a big deal.
And an incredible, he played that Jedi on the game show that they made for Disney Plus that was like young Jedi. It was like a basically American Ninja Warrior for like kids. Mm-hmm. And that character, this is why I love Filoni, because Filoni is in it for the fans. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to make this character canonically in the Star Wars universe by having him be the Jedi that saved Grogu in Mando 3. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so hopefully, you know, part of that, you know, redeeming, he has that moment, which you have.
I also do.
It's in the works, hopefully in the conversation. But new planets, I mean, just awesome.
Yes.
Just so many new things.
And Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan's relationship of Obi-Wan being the immature. Gosh, like seeing Obi-Wan Kenobi as the petulant, kind of like, I don't want to be told what to do by you. Yeah. You know, foreshadowing his relationship with two different Skywalkers where they're going to be like, come on. It was great. I mean, I think you gotta, if you can't find room in your heart for that, I don't know what to tell you. Go watch something else.
We had never seen that. A Jedi and his apprentice on screen. We've never seen that relationship. We've never seen an adventure like that. And so that opening of Phantom Menace where they're in this ship, that was so cool. You got to see all of this, just what you've wanted for so long is the myth of the Jedi, like actually doing Jedi stuff is just so cool. And it they had some CGI, but it was mainly set pieces. Like it wasn't all green screen then, and it was super cool. I really enjoy the droids. I still love the droids. I think the droids, every time they do it, the Roger, I'm all for the droids. And I heard an interview where George, he envisioned, he wanted the lightsabers to cut through them like a hot knife and butter, like no challenge at all, but just kind of like an annoying, like it's gonna be a problem. And I just love that concept. It was, I just, the new things, I was all for it. I rewatched this movie in, you know, preparation for this time. It was so fun.
It's one of my favorites to go back and rewatch. Honestly, you know, I feel like just due to holidays and cable, I get treated to the original trilogy in TV. I love watching the TV edit just because it's entertaining. And it's like, you know, it's kind of, they kind of trim the fat and you can, you know, play on your phone during the commercials, everything that's wrong with today's society, I fully buy into. So I watch those three on TV at least once a year. But I really try and go back now, you know, with streaming, it's so nice. Like, I'm a big physical media person, but like streaming is nice in the sense that I can go watch any Star Wars thing I want.
Click, click, click.
Yeah. So I do enjoy that. And I do try to go, you know, just for fun, or if I have a relative that hasn't seen it, if I can convince one of my nieces or nephews to watch it with me, I try and put it on. And I think, honestly, rewatchability, Phantom Menace is pretty high up there because, like you said, it's just introducing new things every second. New plants, new locations, new aliens, new droids, new weapons, and like and or familiar things, because a lot of kids, I feel like, are getting introduced to Star Wars via animation and video games.
So, and Star Wars Lego too.
Yes, absolutely, huge.
Along with Exhibit C, I'm moving on to this next exhibit because it's thing I haven't mentioned yet, which is also huge: the pod race, Tommy.
Oh my God! Yes,
Huge fan of the pod race. I love it. Yes. That, there's like a 25-30 minute kind of like where the movie like slows way down when they finally get to Naboo and they're getting to Tatooine, which is another cool thing. Yeah. We get to see more of Tatooine.
Yes.
And at this point, it wasn't like, oh, we're back here again.
Yeah. It wasn't like every live action Star Wars TV show where they're like, we got to get on Tatooine somehow.
Yeah, this was like cool. And so the pod race, man, the sound effects.
Yes. Like,
just, oh my gosh, Dolby in the theater. Yeah. I don't know. People don't like this movie, Tommy.
I know. You get a Hutt cameo.
Well, yeah, that was cool. I do have a section here, Why the Hate, which I have kind of five or six things.
Yeah.
But it is cool to be like, oh yeah, the Hutt, Tatooine. Yeah. It was just, again, more world building that you're just like, this is so cool.
I kind of feel like now with the TV shows, we're getting more of like the Hutt Syndicate, these crime syndicate families. Like Solo, a Star Wars movie, did a good job of kind of establishing that like there's this whole mafia element to Star Wars of all of these Crimson Dawn and all these other crime syndicates that basically just like kind of control the underground. And it's like, yeah, the Hutts control the underground. They're giant slugs. Like, how are these people? how are they not all getting murdered all the time? Like, how are any of the smaller, sleeker, more agile aliens not just murdering them? Yeah. It's so fascinating to me. I enjoy. I know that most digital Jabba the Hutt elements or Jabba or most digital Hutt scenes in any iteration of Star Wars get a lot of hate because it's just like. The first Jabba the Hutt in Empire, when you see Jabba the Hutt in Return of the Jedi, it's just so crazy. It's like, and he's so gross and like practical, like this giant Jim Henson creature shop, like
and then Leia on a chain and half a bikini. Yeah. Like it's just a lot of really disturbing things.
It's a lot of stuff that probably doesn't in 2024 hold up as well
Heck no. But Exhibit D in Defense of Phantom Menace, the pod race, man. Yes. That was just so cool. NASCAR and racing was huge in the 90s and 2000s. Like people like forget that. I mean, now it's coming back to Indy Formula One, which is closer to pod racing anyway.
Right. Yeah, you're so right though. But that was like the era of like Jeff Gordon and like that. He was as famous as like almost any professional athlete.
For sure. It was huge. ESPN was always showing NASCAR. Yeah. I mean, it was all in the culture and you had like the pit crew. It was just fun to watch. The sound effects was awesome. You get to see Anakin really show off this like force ability that he really showing us what he's got. Yeah. Like this is
his instincts. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Which we'll talk about that again at the Why the Hate. But I love the pod race. Did you play the 64 game, Tommy?
You better believe I did.
Yeah.
I think that there was a version of that game that came with a special pod racing controller, too, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think the controller did anything different. I think it was just a yellow controller that was kitted out to look like his speeder. Mm-hmm. And I coveted that item. Never got it. But I certainly played many, many rounds of Pod Racer.
Yeah, Pod Racer. And I want to circle back because you brought up a great point in our about marketing and how this movie was marketed. I want to talk about that. That's in maybe Why the Hate. I have a section there, but I have one more exhibit as to in defense of the Phantom Menace. It's the music.
Oh my God. Yes. John Williams, baby. Duel of the Fates.
Tommy, it's the music. Not only do you get the fanfare, I'm partial to the 20th Century Fox, like drum roll fanfare. I miss that at the intro. Yeah. I truly do. Mm-hmm. Some of the best theme music in all of cinema, but then the Duel of Fates at the final battle is still breathtaking. It still is. I don't think I breathed, and I've seen it like 40 times.
I strongly encourage, there is a great YouTube video that I'll have to find and send to you so you can link it.
Yes, I'll put it in the notes.
There is a study of all of the Imperial March embellishments that John Williams hid in Anakin's themes throughout the movie. So there's like all of these little things that like the Anakin theme, which is very upbeat, much like Rey's theme in Force Awakens. But there's like little flourishes of like three notes of the Imperial March hidden throughout it. And like, you have to really, only because I saw this video was I aware of it, because it was like, it's something I don't have the musical ear for, but it's like John Williams was also playing 4D chess with like, you know, with the gosh. Score.
Yeah. And we haven't talked about Darth Maul at all in any of these exhibits. No. He was just incredible. A sub note of a new villain.
Yes.
I think there's a part of hate with that because of how they killed him off so quick, because he's so freaking cool.
Yeah.
But then that final battle is awesome.
It's great. It's great.
And it's not as great as the music, which is insane to say. Yes. Insane to say.
That music video, if you want to understand Zeitgeist, that score was turned into a music video that went to, I believe, number one on MTV's Total Request Live, TRL. Which was like TRL. It was the number one video on TRL, which, I mean, anyone who's young listening to this will have no concept of that. But that's like, right. I don't know. That's like that's like being ranked number one. It's like the number one trending video on TikTok or something. Like
yes,
that.
But trends only reset every day and not that's every right. second. Right.
Exactly.
But it was you come home from school, MTV, TRL, and see Backstreet Boys number one again.
And then here it is. It's John Williams conducting. It's like that's the number one video in America.
And it's still it still slaps, man. Like you turn it's that so on, good. People go, it is so good. And so I don't understand the in defense of the Phantom Menace, Tommy. I mean, we have some five pretty strong exhibits here of like top tier Star Wars creation.
Kind of unassailable, I would say, but you know.
No other movie had more new things than this one.
Certainly not, no. The toys alone, if you were, a Star Wars toy collector, my God, there was so much more to, and that was right. The first one came out in 99.
Yeah.
And I think 96 and 97 is when Kenner started hardcore reprinting the original toys too. So this was an influx again, possibly leading to some of the backlash. You could not escape Star Wars in 1999. No. It was everywhere. It was every restaurant had a tie-in, every store. It was everywhere.
So let's lead that off with why the hate. Yeah. And to say that it's above Jar Jar is, I think, almost accurate because it was everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I think it created this expectation of just impossible expectations to me. It's
absolutely.
I love SNL. And when Justin Timberlake hosted the fifth time, he was Five Timers Club, but he talked about expectations. He's like, hey, I've done D&B. I've done all these things. I've done basketball. Yep. Like these expectations the internet has set is impossible. So just like let it go because it's not going to be that. And I think like kind of because of the oversaturation, because of the like all the marketing, I mean, the Pepsi cans, the whatever, like it was just everywhere.
All the cups, the like. What was it, Pizza Hut, that you could get the cups with the toppers? You could get like the character. I still have I have a Watto cup somewhere in my archives that I got as a gift. But merchandising was everywhere. Commercials, it was every other commercial was the theater. It was the movie theater one that I think was the Taco Bell and Pizza Hut hybrid or like a Pepsi brands commercial where they were like, there was like the kid that was in a Jedi costume and he was sitting next to R2-D2 and like, and all the hype around Padme and, you know, and Queen Princess Amidala or whatever, Queen Amidala. Mm-hmm. It's like all of that. And I will say plot wise as a, you know, I think I was 15 when Phantom Menace came out. I did get a little confused about the Padme Amidala doubles, who's one is Keira Knightley. I didn't even know that at the time. I just thought it was two Natalie Portmans they were doing, like, because they look so. I did get slightly confused about the like Princess Switch element of the movie, but I think, like, why the hate? Certainly, if you're not a Star Wars person, you were never more turned off by it. And when something gets a negative reaction and you're already a hater, the fuel is just it's just the discourse.
I don't remember, Tommy, any other. This was the first movie I remember of people like waiting, like ticket, like seeing multiple times. I mean, Titanic a little bit, that was like 98 kind of, this not like TV crews, not like,
there was
playing it like in line to go to the movie. Like
lawn chairs. Yeah. Camping out in lawn chairs to be the first person in.
This was what started all that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I do think there is a backlash to this and just this in some sense, that's almost as fun as the movie. When The Dark Knight came out, Nolan and company did this huge like pre-movie campaign. It was so much fun. They released $1 bills at Comic-Con with the Joker's face. Like, so it was just fun to follow online and Harvey Dent at night. It was so much fun. And people were just so starving for that kind of, it was just like, I ate it up. I didn't hate it. I loved it all. I did all the riddles. Too. It was super fun.
Oh, same. And by the way, I also ate up Phantom Menace as a proud. I actually, at one point, years later, through my friend, acquired a R2-D2 Pepsi cooler, like one of those displays. Tommy. I had a cylinder R2-D2 Pepsi cooler, which unfortunately, over seven moves in 10 years in L.A., was finally destroyed and put to its proper resting place. But
man, Tommy, I have one of those as well.
You do?
I'm not kidding, Tommy.
Yes.
And yes. I listen to this. I won this cooler. Okay.
Yeah.
I won this cooler at a basketball camp talent show.
Nice.
It was an all-day camp for a week. And at the very end, they always did a talent show. And I did this sketch where I was on a candy shop and had all the coaches and help people be like the drawers, the cash register, the sign. Yeah. And it just made them look ridiculous.
Yeah.
At the very end, they're like, well, where's all your inventory? Where's all the candy? And I'm like, can't you see all these suckers? And it brought the house down.
Love it.
I was like an undersized fifth grader anyway. But I won this R2-D2 cooler. I still have it.
That's so cool. I love it. I'm glad you have it, because I was very disappointed when mine finally had all peeled off and cracked and whatever. But it was a treasured item for a while.
Yeah, dude. It was everywhere. And I think any time like that, there's a backlash. But the most common why is it hated is Jar Jar. We've buried the lead enough, Tommy. Yes. Jar Jar really almost become a huge stumbling block in this movie.
Yeah. Well, he's problematic in the sense that it's like an alien that has like kind of a very crude patois that's like not even like a it's not even placeable to any specific region. It's just kind of like a accent of clearly someone from the Caribbean area. And also, I will say beyond that, it's a main character being introduced to a story that is not grounded in any sense ever. He is never grounded. So it's a lot like doing a comedy, like a sketch comedy or improv comedy. If you're on stage with a performer and they never take a break from whatever shtick that they're doing, the laughs will die off, because it's like, hey, everybody needs a chance to reset and think. Jar Jar never gives the opportunity for anyone to reset. He just constantly acts like a buffoon and screws things up. And when something good happens by his actions, it's completely by accident, because he slips and falls and hits the right thing that sends a droid off into space or something like that, or knocks or hits him with the water cannons or whatever. Anyway, the criticism of Jar Jar is valid, but not enough, in my opinion, to denounce a whole film.
Again, my kids loved him.
Yeah.
They couldn't wait to see what he was doing next.
Absolutely. And I think I think that is another element that, like, as more kids have grown up with watching the prequels first as their first introduction, a lot of those characters, the guy at the diner, that owns the diner that Obi-Wan goes to,
it's like, A-O-B,
exactly.
He's scratching his butt and all that stuff.
There's somehow a 50s cafe in the
Coruscant.
Yeah.
And the Ewoks too, they're little teddy bears. It's not like this is the first time George has done this.
100%.
I mean, they're Ewoks or teddy bears. Yeah. And
they're murderous teddy bears. You're absolutely right.
With like sticks and stones.
Yeah. Catapults.
Like, they're ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Honestly, no, you're absolutely right.
But and the Ewoks, they're live action too. And I think with it being so generated, CGI, it was a huge risk, a huge leap, asking the audience just for the full film.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, he's just always there everywhere. Quiet. Like, it's just like, he's just.
The funny thing is, the dealing with him in the subsequent movies is like, when you make someone so intertwined in the first film, it's like, they knew they had a Jar Jar issue and they're like, we're going to downplay. But it's like, he even becomes a little more like regal, like he is a little slightly more grounded, and in that he only screws up even worse.
Yeah,
he only makes it
dominates Sheev.
Yeah, he's like, no problem, this guy's great. I know, I love they have him. That's why I always love the theory that the most diabolical, the true like Omega Sith in the Star Wars universe is Jar Jar. It's like he knew exactly what he was doing the whole time.
Yes,
it's such a great nerdy theory. Anyway,
so funny. The internet's undefeated. Why the hate? The waste of one of the coolest villains ever created in the Star Wars universe.
And again, thank you, Dave Filoni, for restoring Darth Maul in Rebels, and the episode where he comes back in Rebels in the Sith temple is one of my favorite. I took me a long time to get into the Star Wars animation, honestly. I was just I'm older, and you know,
Dude, I haven't finished it. Yeah, and it stopped me from watching Ahsoka because I want to experience Ahsoka fully.
Yeah, yeah, it's worth it. I think it's worth it. And I will say, like, I know Rebels is a little easier to get. It's only three or four seasons, I think.
Yeah.
Clone Wars is slightly more ambitious because it's like eight seasons and 100-something episodes. And honestly, to be fair, a lot of the episodes are just basically like a lot of cartoons. They're just mapping of previous episodes. The crew has to go to a planet. They meet a person in distress. They help the person in distress. There's a slight tie-in from the Empire, and then rinse and repeat, or whatever, or the Trade Federation, or in Clone Wars, or whatever. So it's tough. It's very tough as an adult to commit to that time, to have that time commitment. But I will say, I do think in the case of, in my opinion, Rebels is worth your time, especially the last two seasons. So,
yes, I've seen the list of episodes you have to watch. Like,
yeah, that is a good way to do it, I think. I think you can obey that. You can adhere to that list and not feel like you missed out on the experience.
Yeah, but he is so cool. He looks terrifying. He's like that demon from Insidious or whatever.
He's got horns coming out of multiple places in his scalp. He's got a red and black demonic face. He has a dual-sided red lightsaber.
So, but the way he like ignites it, you're like, oh, that's just a weird blade. Whoa, he's got two. He got me the first.
Yeah.
But just like walks, like he just, it is so cool. Yeah. And it was terrifying. Yeah. And you're scared for, you're like, these Jedi are brave because I wouldn't want to fight this guy.
No.
Like, it was the coolest thing.
No, he did it. Ray Park, shout out. What an amazingly physically gifted performer.
Why the hate? Because he was so cool, only to be sliced in half after taking down Qui-Gon, though. But still.
I feel like that was the one for one.
Yeah,
like they killed Liam Neeson off in the first movie, and it's like, it'd be kind of hard for. I mean, obviously, for the way the story had to go, you have to get to Palpatine and Anakin,
right?
So it's like. I mean, Dooku is kind of silly because Christopher Lee is so old. but it's like, I don't know that Dooku, but what they Christopher Lee can do is deliver a little information in a very deep, terrifying voice.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dooku was, I think, George Lucas's tribute to Dracula, because which Christopher Lee played in the, I know we've now moved on to a different film. I just love all these tidbits. These tidbits are what fueled me because making that character so ominous and like kind of like almost dignified while being so evil is because he was supposed to be a play on Count Dracula. Yeah. That's why he was Count Dooku.
I always felt like he was just recycling the old English actor who played Obi-Wan. Like, oh, we got for the prequel. We can't get that. Let's get another old knighted
actor. Alec Guinness won't do it. So Christopher Lee is him.
And I mean, the Attack of the Clones, I don't want to do an entire podcast on Attack of the Clones. But again, like, how do we get from like A New Hope, no Jedi, to where we need to go? And to his credit, created a really cool villain. And I will say this, Tommy, at the end of Phantom Menace, and they're like, the Sith rule of two, we're like, who is it? Like, my dad and I talked like for a week about what that, like, it was just. Yeah.
Only two there must always be. Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. And I also think that Darth Maul is very interesting as a non-Sith, as a like powerful, like I think he eventually becomes the head of Crimson Dawn. For a while, he's the king of Mandalore. So he's like the king of all the Mandalorians for a bit. He sits on the throne. He wields the Darksaber. But it's like, I think that I wish that he had been canonically spared in live action, but like if he had been mortally wounded and Palpatine just like abandoned him in disgust and was like, you're dead enough to me, so I'm moving on, or something like that.
Like Palpatine isn't afraid of him or intimidated, and he just like cast him off, and you're like, whoa. Yeah. All right, Tommy, another why the hate, and this might be number two. I might have ordered them, the whole midichlorian thing.
Yeah, the blood testing got weird. That felt a little German science lab in the 1940s to be like, he's pure. The boy is pure. He's the most pure of all of us.
It's a weird spot in the movie. It stops the movie almost in its tracks just to like have this weird
science experiments
at night. And Obi-Wan's like, what is all right, blood? Okay, whoa, this is off the charts. And my kids had a ton of questions, and I'm not just trying to be like, this is what my kids did. And
but I think these movies, like you said, are made for kids. And if they have questions, that means the movie has failed to correctly explain itself for the most
part. They were like, wait, why are they doing this?
Why do they need his blood? Do I have to get my blood drawn? Can I get my blood drawn?
Is that my
midichlorians checked?
What is that word? And that's a new word that wasn't in any other Star Wars.
No.
And
no,
so now you're asking these 30 year at that point, Star Wars fans be like, wait, what? The Force is going to be like defined.
It's a measurable physical trait.
Yeah. What do you think receives more of the responsibility for the hate, Jar Jar or the midichlorian? What do you think's worse, Tommy?
I think over time, the way Star Wars fans like to pick apart the franchise, midichlorians has aged worse than Jar Jar.
I agree.
Like you said, Jar Jar has firmly people have kind of lightened up on him and been like, hey, you know what? He's a goofball. It's fine. It's not like, clearly it's a misfire in terms of like a main character that you want to see a lot of, but it's not like, it doesn't totally ruin the experience. Whereas I feel like midichlorians is one of those things where they're like, this is George Lucas putting a hat on a hat on a hat on a hat. This is five levels extra information and lore or creation plot points that we just don't need.
Leave that in the comics.
Yeah.
Leave that. And I feel like midichlorians are universally disliked by everyone. I've never met someone who was like pro midichlorian.
No.
Like,
but if you're listening, please comment and get to us, because I think we got to come back and talk to you. So,
well, and who knows what they're trying to do with like the cloning stuff.
That's true.
Like,
I am very curious as to where all this, I mean, it seems like it has to be leading to Snoke, of course. Like that's like, you know, but
Grogu, I'm terrified we're going to hear that word again. And it's
right. They're like, you're in like, a lab.
It's going to cancel Grogu because his first word is midichlorian.
Oh God! If his first words are midichlorian, it'll be the greatest moment in Star Wars history. the sound of a thousand people crying out or a million people crying out in agony.
Oh my gosh!
Alderaan is just a million nerds crying out in agony at the same time.
Oh no! Yeah. Alvin Alderaan blue.
Yes.
I think another why they hate. So I think midichlorians is huge. Like that's a big
I think over time it's become definitely the most memeable criticism of the movie. Like Jar Jar now, if you were to come out with a hot anti-Jar Jar take in 2024, I feel like most Star Wars fans would be like, all right, man, whatever. But if you go to a group of Star Wars fans, you're like, midichlorians, those suck, right? Every single person's going to go like, yeah, what the?
Yeah. The real response to the new Rockstar's tweet is midichlorians, you know, are underplayed and should be tested by everybody.
We need to dive further into midichlorian lore.
That's the real controversial.
I might have to go in there and tinker with it.
Wait, you made that post?
No, I didn't. I don't, but I know who did, and I'll dox him if I have to.
Oh my gosh!
I just
so
doxed
funny.
His gender, so there you go.
That's so funny. I can bleep that out if you want me to.
No.
And finally, I think there's one more maybe that might be similar, and we've already gone an hour, so I might have to do a part two of this sometime later, Tommy, because I want to respect everyone's time. Another why the hate is the whole Padme Anakin thing.
It's because we know where it's going, it's like, ironically, Game of Thrones, I feel like, desensitized an entire generation of media viewers into like kind of just being like, I'm going to trust the process here and roll with
George it. George is always ahead of his time. Always ahead of his time.
But it's like Anakin is so young in the first movie. And when he's literally like, are you an angel? It's like, okay.
Which, going back to watch The New Hope, which I think this fits like Obi-Wan's monologue to Luke about what happened to his father. Mm-hmm. If he is, they could have just made him like an 18-year-old dude.
Yeah.
Make him an already grown man.
Right. Yeah.
And make it really make sense that he's too old, because he's a youngling. It's not like he's
the same age as the other kids that are in the Jedi Temple that he murders in the third movie. Spoiler.
Right.
Those are all the same age as Jake Lloyd was in the first movie.
Yeah.
They're like, this guy's way too old.
And so like make him the same age as Obi-Wan, make him older than Obi-Wan. So it's weirder that he has to like listen to his authority. Like there's a lot of just like, And I thought Jake did great when he was like, I've never been an anti Jake fan. I've been an anti Anakin should be 9 fan.
I think that's really smart. Yeah.
Anakin 19. And now all of a sudden, you know, it's not, I don't know. I just think, so I you know, nitpicking, whatever. Yeah. I'm sure there's a reason why he wanted him to be 9, but I think that's another reason. Can you think of anything else? Why the hate for this one, Tommy?
I mean, I think there were, despite it still having some practical elements to it, I do think that there were film purists that argue that it was overproduced and oversaturated and over green screened or blue screened. I believe this was one of the first blue screen technology films, I'm pretty sure. And the fact that it was shot digitally and not on film and all these criticisms leading up to it by quote unquote experts and, you know, and people that are, I mean, they are experts, but they're like, you know, they're experts in effects and practical effects and cinematography. And it's like, yeah, but when you're beaming that message out to people across the country who are just film enthusiasts, it's like, it's kind of like ants at a picnic, you know? It's like, well, yeah, the movie's done. So, you know, you can have your criticisms. And I'm not saying don't speak up, but it's like, there was so much backlash to how digital everything was, I think. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's like, there still are, I mean, the all the Federation aliens, I think, are practical, if I recall. Yeah. It's like, mm-hmm, so much of it is practically done still. A lot of the costuming, it's like, I don't know. I think, again, outrage is profitable, right? We know that. Being mad about something is the best way to make a buck these days. So yeah. I don't think that was any different in 1999.
I think it became easy to crap on Phantom Menace. It became very...
Yeah, because I think it it's the beginning of a new chapter in the saga, a new trilogy. So it's like, it doesn't really have a like super satisfying end. You know, it's kind of like, it's a little bit of a bummer. Qui-Gon is dead. You know, they kind of begrudgingly accept that Anakin must be trained. It's like, you know, it's like, it's not really like a raise your fist and cheer. I mean, despite the parade. But it's like, you know, yeah. I think,
I forgot. Amy saw the Jedi Council, like all these really cool things.
Mace Windu makes his first appearance. We get younger Yoda, who's still a billion years old, but he's young, somehow a little younger. And he's like slightly less crazy, but not really. He's like, he's just kind of a little more of a dick directly.
Dude, like you watch the OG trilogies, Yoda's freaking weird, dude.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Like they market corrected him for the new one to be like, yo, we got to make him like not as psycho.
Yeah.
Like
he's sadistic in the other one. He's like, look over the head for this
weird little frog in Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, for sure.
So, all right, Tommy, this is it. I think talk for another 40 minutes. We're not
Now. Let's do a part two, man.
We'll do a part two. Final defense, like your final kind of plea to the people listening about why Phantom Menace is the best prequel movie.
Well, I'm going to cop out here and say I don't need to defend it. I trust the people listening to this podcast to go back and watch it with your own eyes. Look upon it with your own eyes.
Yes.
As the great Anakin Skywalker once said to his son, look upon it with thy own two eyes. And then, you know what? Recognize, like, this movie is not – it's good. It has a lot of – not only is it not bad, it has a lot of good things. It has great performances. It has – killer music, it has a killer villain, and there's way more good than bad. And you know, if you let the bad consume you, there is only darkness.
I think it's the most Star Warsy film of the prequels. I think you want Star Wars.
Yeah.
Phantom Menace is
I agree.
Quintessential Star Wars. Well, that does it for this episode of the Chase Smith Podcast. Thank you all so much for downloading and listening. Shouts to the Press Play Podcast Network for making this possible. Follow us online at Press Play Pods. Visit our website, new website, dropping a new website Friday, April 5th, pressplaypodcast.com. It looks great. Keep up with all of our shows, network news, and sponsorship information. We're also launching a new show on Friday, our first ever show on politics, Tommy. It's going to be crazy. It's a limited run series from April 12th to the inauguration. It's hosted by New York Times bestseller, CNN political correspondent. It's going to be awesome.
I'll be tuning in.
That's awesome. If you enjoyed today's episode, let me know. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And Tommy, thank you so much. Plug some stuff, man. Where can we listen to more of Tommy B?
You can find me at Tommy Bechtold on all platforms. And you can listen to me on the Guardians of the Galaxy podcast with Mastertainment and Whitney Van Lanningham. You know what? You can hear me back for part two of this podcast. Chase, thank you for having me. I'm glad we finally collided.
Yes.
And got to talk Star Wars, because there's nothing I like more than just free-flowing conversations about Star Wars. As you can see, my brain wants to rain out and talk about every single movie, but I appreciate your patience. I think we were able to have a semi-cohesive conversation here. This is one of my, I feel like I was more under control than I normally am. I really wanted to bring it for the Press Play audience tonight.
Oh, well, you did great. Yeah, but I think we have to talk about the other ones because of the implications. And I think we did a good job. I think we did fine. I think
we did a great job. I'm excited. I can't wait to share this.
Yeah, man. Tommy, thank you so much, man. We'll talk soon.
All right, see ya.